It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
According to the Oxford English Dictionary, is one, a current medium of exchange in the form of coins and banknotes, and two, property, wealth, possessions, resources, etc., viewed as convertible into coins and banknotes, or having value expressible in these terms. That definition describes our natural tendency to think of money in terms of what it will buy. But I've come to think more and more about money in terms of what it costs. For most of us, the money we have was obtained through an exchange of our time, talent, and energy. I think it's worthwhile to pause and take account of the exchanges we make to be sure that they're fair exchanges and that they serve us well. When I was an architecture student living and studying in a small town in France, and being exposed for the first time to a culture other than my own, I came to an awareness of how unhurried life really can be and how hurried life in our country is. I was surprised to see how leisurely life can be and how rich an experience an unhurried life can be. I remembered the carefree days of my childhood, and I made a promise to myself that I would never allow having things to take precedence over doing things, that I would not put material possessions above free time and the enjoyment of life. How well have I done? Well, not so well. I'm very much a product of my culture, and my culture is one of consumption. I don't know when, where, or how our culture became what it is, but it's something I struggle with on a daily basis. I was raised by loving parents who, like most parents, wanted for my sisters and me a better life than they had had. They told us as much. By this, they meant that we should have more and work less. Having grown up on farms in Depression-era America, they spent a good deal of their youth working and having very little in the way of material possessions. My sisters and I were not expected to do a whole lot other than some assigned chores to teach us responsibility. And my parents didn't talk to us about money. They didn't want us to be burdened as they had been in their childhood with concerns about money. So it was my grandparents who talked to us about money. Papa Smith, my paternal grandfather, told me that as long as one spends less than one makes, all is well. Like Thoreau, he chose to make do with little, allowing himself plenty of time for fishing, playing dominoes, visiting with family and friends, playing with his grandchildren, and reading his Bible. He spent a lot of time reading his Bible. And I would be surprised to learn that he had any money at all when he died. Daddy Kennemer, my maternal grandfather, told me that if I watched my pennies, my dollars would take care of themselves. He watched his pennies very carefully, and he had a lot of money in the bank when he died, but he didn't enjoy life very much. The best advice I got came from Mother Kennemer, my maternal grandmother, who always said, "Money is a good servant, but a poor master." So you might want to write that one down. Money is a good servant, but a poor master. For me, the daily challenge is trying to strike a balance between having the money I need to do the things I want to do and living free from worry about money, from being enslaved by a need for money and more money. I enjoy my work. I have the extreme good fortune to have found a profession that suits my bifarious nature, that involves both science and art, with each informing the other. And I'm thankful to be so lucky. But I would almost always be happier sitting with good friends, discussing ideas, laughing, getting lost in the flow of time, than meeting the demands of schedules and sometimes unreasonable clients. On a beautiful day, I'd rather be hiking along Barton Creek or working in the garden than sitting at a desk. I'd rather practice architecture for fun than for money. And I'd proudly wear the title dilettante if I could make my vocation and my avocation one and thereby reclaim every moment of my life as my own. I don't have children, but if I did, I'd want things to be better for them than they have been for me. Just like my parents, I'd want them to work less and have more. More time to enjoy and appreciate the best things life has to offer. More time to relax with friends and family, to discuss ideas, to read great books, to express themselves through art and artful living, and fully develop their talents. More time to work on the things that build community and make life better for everyone. I'd want to teach them that life is a wonderful journey, a mystery to be experienced to the fullest. And I'd want them to understand that journeys are best when the luggage is light.
In the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Let us be grateful for all the parents in this room. They have taken on the responsibility for lives in addition to their own. They are the stewards of our collective future, and we are grateful for their work and their sacrifices. Let us be aware of and grateful for the work and the sacrifices each of us make as we try to steer our way through life by serving those things most worth serving. And let us have God's worth serving with our lives. Let us have meaningful work toward positive ends so we can all feel like stewards of our collective future. Let us work to establish relative relationships with relative ends, but absolute relationships with absolute ends. And let us learn how to tell the difference between the two. For the problem with the world is seldom with its people. We are overwhelmingly good people, doing the best we know how to do. Let us remember that. The problem with the world is that far too often we serve gods not worth serving at all. Let us be more aware of the gods we are serving, and let us be sure they are worth serving with the days and years of our lives. Let us attend to the gods we are serving with our lives. Amen. One reason it's a tough topic to preach about money is because you already know all the things churches are programmed to say about money. Love of money is the root of all evil. We could almost say them together. You could serve God or mammon, but not both. And don't you be worshiping golden calves and all the rest of it. Another reason it's tough is that the U.S. economy is so bad in so many ways that many of you sitting here are working as hard as you know how to work just to pay the bills and get the things that you want for yourselves and your families. And then to end a week like that and to come to church and get assaulted for wanting money would be kind of like piling on. So talking against the love of money is a little bit like trying to tell a fish it shouldn't be swimming in quite so much water. It's just part of everything we do. And every time I say money isn't as important as we make it out to be, someone will say, "Well, then you don't need my pledge." Don't ever say that. And we do need your pledge. I ask and expect
members to pledge 5% of their pre-tax income to this church or to whatever church you find that you think is worth supporting. Because a good, honest church is about the only institution in our lives where we can routinely question the gods that we serve the rest of the week and ask whether they're serving us too. Don has already done a nice job of talking about the ways money intersects with our personal lives, so I'll go in a different direction. I want to bring you some thoughts about money and mostly frame them by putting them inside of two very old stories, wonderful stories. I think they're two of the best ever written about wanting money too much or letting work take over your life and what happens when we do that. Both the stories come from the Greeks. The first is the most famous, and it's one you all know, the story of King Midas. Midas couldn't get enough money. Since he was king, he didn't actually have to earn the money, but he still wished it were easier to convert the world around him into gold. And so he made that famous wish, and the wish was granted in that double-edged way. The Greek gods loved granting wishes. This is the origin of the saying, be careful what you wish for. And everything Midas touched turned to gold. This made it very difficult to eat. And the real tragedy of the story, of course, was that one of the things he touched was his beloved daughter, who then became a golden statue. Like all good myths, there are a lot of directions to go with the old Midas story. There are a lot of ways to turn people into statues, to take the life out of us by acting as though their only purpose were somehow to create wealth or gold. Because if they can't make money then, or become money, they're useless. I've been thinking about a figure that I read you a few weeks ago that I'm having a hard time getting out of my mind. I read a report estimating that 18,000 Americans are now dying each year because of inadequate health care. 18,000 Americans each year dying of inadequate health care. They haven't got the money for the insurance. And if they haven't got the money, they're apparently not worth saving. At least the cost it would take to save them is not a high priority in our society. We're spending money somewhere else, and the cost of it, among other things, is 18,000 Americans, six times as many as died in the attacks in 9/11, die every year. 70 years ago, Hitler's Nazis coined a horrible name for people like this. They were called useless eaters. Useless eaters. You only have a use if you can produce something, and your worth is measured by how much you can produce for others. And if you can't produce enough or pay your own way, you're a useless eater. One of the most chilling phrases I think I've ever heard. This may not feel quite like the King Midas story, but it's closer than you think. Midas' daughter was no longer a warm, loving, worthwhile human because she'd been converted into gold, which is really the lowest form of currency. Now that sounds backwards. Everything seems to be based on gold. But it's not the currency in which human worth can be measured. I read somewhere that if you collected all the raw materials in our bodies, all the chemicals and things, you'd be lucky to sell the whole lot for $5. So money can't be the right currency for measuring our worth. Yet when we're valued and our lives are valued primarily by how much money we can make, then the chief way that we're different from King Midas's daughter is that we're not even worth as much as a golden statue. That's disturbing. The Midas story doesn't dwell too much on the other side of the story, which is the fact that if you want to value people primarily as people, primarily for their humanity, then you probably won't make as much money off them. But I think that's true too. The story of Midas today would be so easy to try to assail you with in your personal lives, and I'm just not going to do it. I think that you're working hard enough as it is, and you just don't need to be beaten down for it. I think the Midas story today is about the attitudes that we have toward money as a society. The performance of our economy, and this is something most of us think is simply axiomatic, the performance of our economy, a healthy economy, has been defined for several decades by how well the stock market works. 40 years ago, it wasn't. 40 years ago, it was defined by how well the middle class was doing. Some of you remember that. After World War II, the American economy was a point of pride because people on one paycheck could afford to buy a home and send their kids through college. And that was the measure of a healthy economy. It's changed in the last 40 years. It's amazing. But if a healthy economy is one in which those who own stocks make money, then you're in the King Midas story. Because all workers are now converted to things not only to make money, but to things that can cost money. If you fire workers, if you right-size, if you downsize, if you eliminate benefits or pensions, stock prices rise, and the people who own stocks make money, and it's defined as a healthy economy. That's quite a shift in just 40 years. Our challenge, and I think it's a religious challenge, is to learn how to establish relative relationships with relative things and absolute relationships with absolute things, and how to know the difference. Which should be ranked higher, the profits of a few or the livelihoods of many? Stock dividends or health insurance and job security for workers? The priorities are our choices. Earning more money or having richer and more satisfying relationships? Either way, there's a cost of money. There are things it buys and things it costs us. And money reaches everywhere. I've read recently that the leading reason for divorces in our country is not having enough money, and the tension and the stress and the fights that that brings about and what that does to relationships. So I don't think you can separate money even from love, even from relationships. So one cost of valuing profits above people is that we soon diminish the humanity of most of the people around us and the richness and the warmth of our own relationships. And that's pretty close to a modern version of the King Midas story. Now, the other Greek story isn't as well known, but it's at least as good, and it's one of my favorites. It's the story about Hephaestus, who was the Olympian god, the one that Romans called Vulcan. He was the only god who worked. But he didn't just work. Work was his life. He lived to work. Work was more important than anything else. Work absorbed his passion, his love, his spirit. He didn't work to live, he lived to work. What a difference there is when you turn that sentence around. When we live to work, it's very hard to make room for another human being in our life. The Greeks, with their wonderful ironic wit, had married Hephaestus to Aphrodite. Not surprisingly, she was never faithful to him and never seen with him. He was at work. Now, this isn't quite like turning the people around us into gold, but the old Greek story of Hephaestus comes pretty close to saying that, though maybe even more creatively. It's said that one of the things about Hephaestus was that he created golden servants, robots, to help with his work. What some interpreters have done with this is to say that this is what happens to those in the lives of people who just live to work rather than working to live. Without any energy or interest left for personal relationships, their mates and sometimes children are assigned roles, much like the roles of golden servants, doing chores, cleaning, cooking, converting life into a series of duties. It's very robotic. I suspect we've all experienced this, and I suspect most of us have done this at one time or other. Now, this is a hard lesson to go on very heavily today when both the adults in many families have to work to pay the bills, and some people have to take more than one job. I'm not sure this is our fault. And I don't think it's fair to throw blame around when people are doing the best that we know how to do. Now, and where we choose to spend money brings costs that are usually unseen. I discovered a website this week that's been around a while, but I hadn't known till now. It's one you should all check out. It's fairly easy to remember. It's www.costofwar.com. It's quite an amazing website. You can see the cost of the war mounting as the numbers spin by as you watch, rising hundreds and thousands of dollars a second. It's amazing. And then, to bring it home, you can click on individual cities or states and find out how much the war costs the citizens of those cities or states. I did that for Austin. So far, the cost of the war for us in Austin is almost $500 million. $500 million. That's nearly $400 for each man, woman, and child in the greater Austin metro area, if we have 1.3 million. That means we got $80,000 to $100,000 right here in this room that we're spending on a war and not spending on other things. So the cost of that money is that we're not spending it on education, we're not spending it on health care, we're not spending it on 1,000 other things that the money could be spent on. This isn't just leftist rhetoric or street poetry. It's very simple truth. The cost of our economic priorities, just like the cost of King Midas's, is paid in devaluing the common humanity of all the common humans around us, including us. I wonder if you haven't felt some of this in your own life. When we exalt profits over people, it means we don't value people as much as we value profits. And if this doesn't sound religious, I don't know what is religious. This is exactly the meaning of the cry from the prophet Amos of 2,500 years ago when he said that his people were selling the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes. Couldn't that have been written this week? How different does our world sound? To me, it sounds very different from the America that I grew up in 40 and 50 years ago. Now, there's another dimension to the story of Hephaestus and his golden robots that's worth considering. When Hephaestus decided to devote his whole life to work, all of the other gods completely rejected his silly choice. Not a single other god thought that the point of life was just to work, because they knew there were so many other options. But a generation later, those in the household of Hephaestus didn't know there were other options, didn't know there were other ways of life. So they went about their work robotically. They lived to work rather than working to live, and they thought that's the way things are. See how easily it happens? For me, this whole subject raises a lot of questions, a lot more profound than answers, and a lot more frustrating. Does the money we spend enrich our lives, help us have more fertile experiences, more nuanced appreciation of life, more creative engagement with others, richer relationships where we can truly know and be known? Is that what the money we're spending does? Or does our money buy distractions from human interaction? Do we spend money on distractions to avoid relationships that aren't very rich because we just don't know how to relate to others richly? Money can be a good servant, but it's a terrible master. When you think of the amount of time and energy and passion you spend earning money, do you think it is more like your servant or your master? This is dangerous territory. We have a word for people who sell themselves for money, and it isn't a nice word. And when people are simply owned by money, I think of some of the Asian workers who are reportedly chained to their workstations, but also people here in Austin working two or even three jobs to make ends meet. When people's lives are nearly defined by the need to work in order to survive, isn't that a kind of slavery? Is that the cost of valuing money so highly? The enslavement and prostitution of our bodies, our spirits, and far too much of our lives? I don't have your answers. I struggle with these issues too. And as Don admitted in his affirmation, I don't always do very well either. But I can offer you some questions that might be useful. What's the cost of the money you're earning? What's the cost of the money you're spending? What aren't you spending it on? Are you working to live or living to work? What are you serving with the days and years of your lives? And does it serve the best parts of you? Are these gods worth serving? Or put it this way. If you were to die this month, and in your eulogy, you were defined by what you have spent the major energies of your life pursuing, would you be proud of having lived that life? And does that give you any ideas?